Hello, my name is Ruben Mesa, and I'm the Executive Director of the Mays Cancer Center at UT Health San Antonio MD Anderson. And welcome to this ASH 2020 highlights in myeloproliferative neoplasms. I'm joined tonight by two very good friends and wonderful MPN experts, Dr. Aaron Gerds, Associate Professor of Medicine at the Cleveland Clinic, and John Mascarenhas, Associate Professor of Medicine at Mount Sinai. It should be a great discussion today. So we're going to be having a review of some of the challenges and unmet need in your management of patients with MPNs. We're going to have a high-level summary of some of the key data coming from this year's ASH and how it might impact your practice. And we'll discuss some of the new therapies and how they might fit into managing MPNs. Now, when we're speaking of myeloproliferative neoplasms today, we're going to be focusing in particular on polycythemia vera and myelofibrosis. Now, polycythemia vera and essential thrombocythemia are kind of our earlier MPNs. We know these diseases start with driver mutation acquisition, JAK2, CALR, or MPL. There are now additional modifying mutations, ASXL1, amongst others, that occur during the progression of the disease. Now, early on in the course of these illnesses, there's a risk of vascular events, difficulty with symptoms, occasional splenomegaly, and as the diseases progress into overt myelofibrosis, there can be splenomegaly, cytopenias, extramedullary hematopoiesis, bone marrow fibrosis. In that phase, the disease becomes typically more life-threatening. And finally, the diseases can progress to acute myeloid leukemia. Now, these patients have quite a variable disease course. They are heterogeneous. There's even three diseases we're speaking of. So when we are developing our treatment plans, we need to be mindful of what are our goals. Is it avoiding thrombosis and bleeding? Is it improving symptoms? Is it increasing activity or decreasing splenomegaly? Are we working to improve low blood counts in myelofibrosis? Are we working to decrease progression, prevent progression, or live longer? All of these are important considerations as we assess both where we currently stand, but several of the new therapies we're discussing as they try to broach new areas of efficacy. So let's kick off with polycythemia vera. Now in 2021, we need an accurate diagnosis, develop our treatment plan, and develop our frontline medical therapy, and then we want to be certain to be evaluating for potential progression, movement into second line if need be, or shift gears altogether if we are treating AML. Now, we developed NCCN guidelines over the years. I was the inaugural panel chair, and now Dr. Gerds is the current panel chair. And with these, we stated in polycythemia vera the importance of monitoring counts, the importance of phlebotomy and aspirin in lower-risk patients, and cytoreduction in higher-risk patients. Now, there was a nice analysis done by our colleagues at Yale demonstrating the importance of appropriately starting frontline therapy for these patients. And they were able to look at overall survival as well as thrombosis-free survival, demonstrating the importance of utilizing hydroxyurea, utilizing that frontline therapy when appropriate. Now, there are treatment gaps that remain in PVERA. There are both in the guidelines that are out there, Hydrea and interferon, both as considerations for frontline. Which of those should we use? How do we prevent disease progression? JAK inhibition is approved in the second line setting with ruxolitinib. How early should we be weaving that into consideration? Indeed, there are two types of interferons that are actively being explored. Ropegylated interferon, alpha-2B, which is approved in Europe, and there was data at ASH in use in low-risk PV, and pegylated interferon alpha-2A, that those of us in the MPN Research Consortium, John and I and our colleagues, performed trials either alone as single agent or as second line. Now, one of the first abstracts was the from this year's ASH, the long-term use of ropegylated interferon, the five-year results from the randomized control study. The initial study was a proud PV, ropeg versus hydrea at 12 months, and then the continuation PV, 60-month interim analysis to look at the long-term. And indeed, with PV, we're thinking of a long-term suppressive therapy, so long-term data is very relevant as we consider these patients. Our colleagues, Heinz Gisslinger and colleagues, reported that when we take the long view, that perhaps at a year, hydrea and interferon are roughly similar in terms of CHR. But as we get further and further out in terms of follow-up, it's very clear that there is superiority of ropegylated interferon over hydroxyurea for these patients. There also seems to be a better control of the JAK2 allele burden for these patients, which again makes it potentially intriguing as a more disease-modifying therapy. In terms of rate of vascular events, roughly equivalent, although the numbers are quite low in both arms, so difficult to see much daylight between those. Lower rates of disease progression in the ropegylated arm versus the control arm. In terms of safety, good safety with the ropegylated arm, not a clear major difference in terms of SAEs between these agents. So let me open it up. So first, Aaron, what do you think are some of the greatest unmet needs in PV?
Well, thank you, Ruben, and it's a pleasure to be here with you and John to discuss these topics. I think there are a lot of needs still in PV. I think you hit the nail on the head there with disease modification, stuff that can really delay progression, delay disease moving forward in time, or even resetting the clock back to earlier forms of the disease would really be wanted. Because although a lot of patients will stay in a chronic phase, a lot do progress. I think a lot of times too, these agents can, hydroxyurea and interference can control counts, but in some people it doesn't control their symptoms, and I think additional agents to help really directed at their symptoms they may be having can be a big help as well. So I think those are kind of the two main categories in my mind.
Great. Now, John, you and I have chewed on this issue of interferon with our own analysis of the MPNRC studies. How compelling do you think U.S.-based hematologists would find particularly this last set of kind of longer-term data on ropegylated interferon?
I think the trick when you're looking at treating a PV patient, particularly with interferon, is sort of the long game. One doesn't really look to achieve immediate responses with interferon alpha 2A or 2B for that matter. So I think if one's looking for instant gratification, I think really hydroxyurea is probably the agent that will achieve that. But if one's looking for the potential for disease course modification and using the JAK2 V617F as a surrogate marker of that, then one really needs to be invested in sort of temper expectations for the patient, for the physician, for everyone involved. That really takes time to achieve those kinds of responses, and patients have to be followed over the course of years. I think the biggest obstacle is likely going to be inexperience with interferon. I think most hemonc docs in the community are pretty comfortable with hydroxyurea and oral therapy, for the most part, well tolerated. Older docs who've had use of interferon with CML but prior to the TKIs probably are comfortable, and then those of us that do a lot of MPN are comfortable. But I think it's going to take time to achieve that comfort level through education and other mechanisms, so that docs and patients alike feel comfortable using a biologic like interferon.
Wonderful. Now, let's pivot a bit. So that's a discussion really in frontline. Now, patients clearly can fail frontline for a variety of reasons. Toxicity, maybe they have a vascular event, maybe they have other issues in terms of inadequate efficacy. So let's pivot to an abstract I was involved with, but John, you presented this. So I'll quickly run through your slides, but it's regarding an agent, idasanutlin, in hydrea-resistant or intolerant P. vera patients. Now, this was, again, a second-line study. They had PV. They had failed hydroxyurea. They were phlebotomy-dependent, and they were receiving idasanutlin looking at response. And this was a phase 2 study. And you presented, you know, good clinical activity, control of hematocrit, CHR, and again, this is in second-line patients, European leukemia, net response, both CR and PR in the majority of individuals, you know, and composite response, you know, of the majority of individuals, realizing it's a phase 2 trial. There was reduction in spleen volume in some patients. Now, mind you, only a subset of patients clearly have splenomegaly, but you see the waterfall plots with these individuals. Also saw reduction in platelet counts. In again, not all patients evaluable for a platelet count response, control of the leukocyte count. An area of my interest, improvement in MPN-related symptoms. And again, clearly saw that there could be improvement in MPN-related symptoms in individuals, again, who had failed hydroxyurea. Now, the MDM2 inhibitors do have some issues with toxicities, and GI toxicities really all being kind of at the top of the list there, as you see kind of across the board. The grade 1-2 nausea did lead to dose reduction in a few patients, as well as some dose interruptions. John, maybe I'll have you first comment as you've chewed most on this data. You know, what are your thoughts in terms of both the efficacy as well as the tolerability of this agent for PV?
It's bittersweet. It's clearly an active agent. We saw that early on through the Research Consortium 115 study of idasanutlin, and that really informed the phase 2 study. And what we've learned from that study is you can have an effective drug, and what, you know, what we didn't show in today's webinar are the molecular responses that were presented at the meeting as well, which were quite dramatic. I mean, we had 85% VAF reduction within, you know, 4 to 6 months of therapy, and I'm not really aware of other therapies that have such dramatic changes in mutant allele burden. So it's clearly active and on target, and informed by preclinical studies conducted by Ron Hoffman and Min Liu. But the problem is that the tolerability is such from the GI toxicity that it's very challenging to deliver it month after month. And if you're treating patients with acute illnesses like AML with a very set number of cycles of therapy, you know, that may be doable. But if you're giving patients with chronic disease therapy on a basis of a monthly basis every 4 weeks for 5 days, and there's GI toxicity, even grade 2, that becomes difficult after multiple cycles of therapy. So the lesson learned here is, as good as the drug may be, if it's not really well tolerated, it ain't that good. So I think the mechanism's on target, and I'd love to see other MDM2 inhibitors, perhaps KRT-232 or HDM-201 from Novartis, other drugs in the class, take a try, both in the PV and MF space, and maybe the toxicity profile will be better and the on-target activity will be there.
Yeah, very true. Now, Aaron, you know, as a current panel chair for the guidelines, clearly ruxolitinib is a second-line therapy for PV. What do you think some of the characteristics of whether it be an MDM2 inhibitor or perhaps some of the agents we will end up discussing about myelofibrosis might, of course, pivot to be tested in PV? But what do you think a second-line agent needs to show in PV to really be a credible option?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. I think at a fair minimum, you know, controlling the blood counts, I think would be the first criteria to being a second or third line drug in PV. You know, the one thing that we know that ruxolitinib can do pretty well is address symptom burden, and I think that's really its niche there in the second line setting, in addition to controlling counts. But like John mentioned, with the idasanutlin, the exciting part was what it was doing under the hood. You know, the reductions in allele burden that we saw would really prove the on-target effect. And I think the one thing that the study didn't really capture was Some of the patients that, when their treatment was done, they went many months without needing phlebotomies, even after coming off study. So a couple of my patients went, you know, roughly 12, 13, 14 months without needing phlebotomies after coming off study. So getting back to that earlier point about disease modification, I think is something really exciting for polycythemia vera. And I think a lot of these agents that we are looking right now in the second and third line setting, and even in myelofibrosis, when they drift over to PV, and when we really start to explore them in PV, we're hoping to see some more of that evidence that they do modify disease.
No, it's very true. You know, I was doing telemedicine visits earlier this afternoon, a few new patients with PV, some of them fairly new to the diagnosis. And again, I try to frame this disease. I mean, it's a neoplasm. It clearly can be progressive. But it's a chronic disease. I mean, some people have PV for decades.
Yep.
You know, so I try to frame it in their own mind, you know, because they're thinking neoplasm and they hear that word and they're thinking pancreas cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer. You know, the dynamics are really dramatically different on many levels. I try to frame it more accurately like a disease like lupus. The mechanism is different, but it's a chronic disease. Requires chronic therapy. There are many individuals that will live out their normal lifespan, but there are some that it can become progressive and have, you know, very difficult complications or fatal complications. So I do think the chronicity is an important fact. And as John says, you know, the patient's willingness to put up with toxicity is clearly and appropriately more limited. You know, if any of us need to withstand four cycles of intensive chemotherapy to overcome a cancer, we'll do it. We'll hold our noses, you know, we'll struggle through it. We'll take a time off from work, you know, whatever. But that's for curative therapy. Maybe we'll evolve to the point where, again, we have curative therapy, but it has a period of recoverable toxicity that maybe we'll choose to do for PV. But a chronic day in and day out therapy, you know, that issue of tolerability is key. But particularly when the current landscape is overall pretty well tolerated. Hydrea, for most people, can tolerate it pretty well. Ropeg, as we saw, most people, not all, but most people tolerate it pretty well. Ruxolitinib, we saw that nice response to data presented, the 5-year data at this year's ASH. From Pasamonte showing 5-year durable improvements in splenomegaly symptoms, hematocrit control. That was the trial that they did not need to have splenomegaly. So all good. Well, let's pivot now. Loop in another interesting drug, again from one of your colleagues, John, at a group PTG-300. This is a hepcidin mimetic, which acts to basically simulate anemia of chronic disease, make people phlebotomy independent, hopefully let their iron levels come up. This was the design, open label in individuals either with or without cytoreduction, but at a stable way. John and his colleagues demonstrated very nicely control of the need for phlebotomies in these individuals. And you see kind of the need for the phlebotomies on the left and kind of freedom on the right. A nice graphical way of showing complex data. Well done. Control in the decrease in the hematocrit and red cell count, of course. Part of the premise, improvement in iron and improvement in ferritin to go along with that. Again, it warms my heart to see that as a field, we continue to look closely at patients' symptoms as part of efficacy, which we should, just in parallel with other parts. And again, some improvements. Now, are these from improved counts, more even control of hematocrit, decrease in iron deficiency? It may be some of each. Difficult to know how much each contribute, but probably all are relevant. In terms of toxicities, overall, fairly well tolerated. This is an injectable drug. Some mild injection site reactions, no serious tox, no grade 3 or 4 tox, some mild GI tox, but looks overall better tolerated than the MDM2 inhibitor. So here, a different sort of agent, non-cytoreductive agent in the traditional sense, but control of hematocrit, and possibly could be a role for even low-risk PV patients that currently get phlebotomy and aspirin. So maybe I'll ask, Aaron, the first question. So currently lower-risk mm-hmm. patients were doing phlebotomy and aspirin. If all of this held out through a positive phase 3, you know, what would you need to see to have you think that could be an option for lower-risk patients?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think this is it could potentially be a great option for lower risk patients. You know, phlebotomies can be a burden, and people can really feel the effects of iron deficiency, and this could potentially alleviate that in addition to controlling their counts. You know, it would save time away from work. You know, you don't have to go into the infusion room. You can just give yourself the shot at home, which is great. It could be a self-administered medication because it's subcutaneous. So I think these things are all really important. You know, showing efficacy. You know, I think the way the phase 2 trial was designed here, it kind of took all comers, folks who were getting just phlebotomies on Hydrea, on interferons, and then added this kind of on top. So I would anticipate more information coming out of the phase 2 on what populations it seems to work the best in. Traditionally, after phlebotomy becomes difficult for a patient who's low risk, we think about hydroxyurea or interferons. So this might have to be something where we think about patients who are receiving phlebotomies, not tolerating phlebotomies, and then potentially randomized against one of those other agents. I know I'm kind of sliding into the next question, and sorry about that. But I think it would have to show kind of similar response rates to these other agents that we would often reach for after phlebotomy.
Great. Well, John, maybe I'll have you comment, because you have the most firsthand experience. Maybe comment on the agent, but again, what do you think a phase 3 needs to show with obviously only discussing what's in the public domain?
So as Aaron pointed out, mechanistically, it's a really interesting agent that takes a different spin on treating the disease, because it's really affecting hepcidin and iron metabolism distribution and essentially choking off red blood cell production. You know, what it probably doesn't do necessarily is have, you know, clear anticlonal activity. And once you stop the drug, one would presume that the red cells would go up again. And, you know, one is not expecting white count and platelet count control nor significant, you know, JAK2, V617F burden reduction. So to me, the trick will be trying to figure out how best to run a phase 3 study that that clearly defines a population that this drug would address an unmet need. And I'm not quite sure that low-risk patients per se would meet that criteria. I mean, I can definitely think of a few patients, at least in the practice, that have significant tolerability issues with phlebotomy. And you know, those patients, if they were unable to tolerate cytoreductive therapy or unwilling, this may be a therapy to offer patients like that. So although I think this is a great example of, you know, brilliant science, really interesting mechanism. But if you start to really think it through all the way through, I'm not totally clear what the patient population would be that's best suited for this. And although I can definitely think of patients here and there in the context of a trial where one needs to have a defined patient population and then an outcome measure that can be that can be even between the two groups, requires, I think, some serious thought.
Well, good. Well, a very interesting mechanism of action. I think much for us to learn. And I think as we end up talking about momelotinib, it's interesting this hepcidin question, where here we're using a hepcidin mimetic to create a decrease in erythrocytes. And on the flip side, we see with momelotinib, as we'll discuss, a reason to increase erythrocytes. So let's pivot to MF, myelofibrosis. And now this for many is more like a solid tumor malignancy in terms of its natural arc or seriousness. Not for all, but for many. Here again, an accurate diagnosis. We assess survival and disease burden. Do they have splenomegaly? Do they have anemia? Are they progressing? We need to be considering the role of stem cell transplant. Frontline medical therapy, it's been ruxolitinib for almost a decade. Now we have fedratinib as a frontline option. Encourage people to consider that in those with moderate thrombocytopenia. If they progress, do we move on to transplant? Do we go to second line? Fedratinib as an approved agent in that space if someone already got ruxolitinib or a trial. And then if not, movement to AML type therapy. Now, the landscape, we've got fedratinib and ruxolitinib, which I mentioned. We've got two coming up on their heels. Pacritinib for that myelodepleted phenotype. People with low platelets, exciting data coming out there. Possible approval in the near future. Momelotinib, JAK1, ACVR1, JAK2 inhibitor from Sierra. Ongoing trials at the moment. So with that, I'll share a trial that a Serge and I presented at this year's ASH related to survival and efficacy of momelotinib for patients with MF. There was the Simplify 1 study. This was the frontline study. Simplify 2, this was the second line study. It showed that, one, a differentiator in Simplify 1, that people were able to take the full dose of momelotinib. So it's heme profile as it related to tolerability for anemia and thrombocytopenia allowed more fuller dosing, which it could be potentially an advantage. There are frequent times we know that there's way overutilization of suboptimal doses of ruxolitinib in the community. Perhaps part of that could be improved. But way too many people out there on 5 twice a day of ruxolitinib, a dose that, although can provide some symptom improvement, may be modest for efficacy. We see here nice data as it relates to spleen response and duration of spleen response. We see nice data as it relates to both transfusion independence and duration of transfusion independence for that momelotinib as well as the Rux to momelotinib crossover. And part of that mechanism we now believe is due to the inhibition of ACVR1. That is doing, again, the opposite of that PTG300 in inhibiting hepcidin, decreasing that inflammation, allowing erythropoiesis to occur. Again, improvements in anemia in that Simplify 2 study, the second line study. Data we presented as well was the survival, median overall survival of 53 months in the Rux to momelotinib patients, and not a median not achieved in those who've been on momelotinib the whole time. These are survivals. Again, there's not a long-term control arm, but these are survivals really much better than we would have thought going into the study based on the risk of the patients. Similarly, for Simplify 2, this is second line. Normally, second line patients, survivals can be poor, 2 years or less by data from MD Anderson, and here, 3 years or more. So let me ask you, Aaron, first. So, you know, we're seeing some improvement in survival with momelotinib. We've seen improvement in survival with long-term analysis from the COMFORT study. We're going to get around to John's imetelstat study in a little bit that also speaks of survival advantage. Do you think that any therapy that clearly has an impact, you improve spleen, you improve symptoms, do you think we're there yet to say that that likely is predictive of improvements in survival?
Kind of yes and no. So clearly patients, as you mentioned, on these trials are living longer when getting the active agent or getting the ruxolitinib or getting the momelotinib, which is, I think, a great thing. You know, we're all looking for this disease modification. That is, right? That is technically disease modification when they're living longer. You know, but I think a lot of that might be because they're, you know, lowering cytokine levels long term, decreasing complications, shrinking spleens, better nutrition, improved in the case of momelotinib, perhaps fewer transfusions, and avoiding some anemia, are all kind of helping translate into this improved survival. But this kind of ultimate goal of eradicating the clone or reducing the amount of malignant clone in the bone marrow, I don't think any of those types of agents we're seeing. Now, imetelstat that we're going to talk about in the future might be doing some more deeper changes there. And I think that's what we're really looking for. But certainly there is a place for momelotinib. I think really the most telling part of that analysis was that even in the relapse refractory setting, patients were getting transfusion independence for, you know, on average of 50 weeks, which is phenomenal. You know, that's better than a lot of the other agents we have to improve anemia. And in the frontline setting, the patients were getting transfusion independence for, you know, 3 to 4 years at least. So I think those are really impressive numbers and can really be a big benefit to that population who are anemic and need a JAK inhibitor therapy as well.
So now, John, obviously we spend a lot of time, the three of us, thinking in the MPN Research Consortium about myelofibrosis. How do we cure the disease, you know, and how do we prolong survival? Why do you think we're seeing improvement in survival with these agents, even with different mechanisms of action?
I think Aaron said it best. You know, I don't know that we know. I've thought about this a lot. Is it really the shrinkage of the spleen that predicts the survival, or is it what you're doing to shrink the spleen that's really associated with the survival? So perhaps, you know, as the data has been shown before, the deeper the spleen response with ruxolitinib, perhaps the better the survival outcome. But I'm not entirely sure. I believe that's because the spleen is literally smaller, but it might be you're just optimizing the amount of JAK2 inhibition. And that's really the goal of therapies like this. And you know, a lot of time and attention has been spent trying to analyze, well, you know, the patients don't go into molecular remissions, they don't go into pathologic remissions, but there is a believable survival benefit from both COMFORT studies when you follow them long term. It's there. And I think Aaron hit it. I think it's, you know, their cachexia is reversed, their performance status is improved. I think they're less likely to have inflammatory mediated complications, and patients do better. Unfortunately, most patients eventually progress too. So, you know, there's still so much more to do. And I don't know that every drug that can shrink spleen to a comparable level will have that survival benefit. But, you know, I think I'm enthusiastic or optimistic that we have trials now that actually look at survival as an endpoint. It, you know, sort of moves the dial forward. And, you know, whether we're going to figure out whether there's a clear biomarker that associates with survival. And I thought Aaron said it really well. I mean, it's probably the most important disease course modification we can offer a patient is to prolong their life. But right now, we don't have a clear, even JAK2, we don't have a clear marker that achieving a significant reduction in JAK2 means the patient will necessarily live a longer, better life. So there's still a lot of research interest dedicated to figuring that part out so that we can design trials that can hopefully have early reads and move drugs, you know, forward quickly.
Good. No, I agree. I think, you know, improvement in splenomegaly and symptoms are biomarkers of response. But I don't think we still fully know, you know, what is the exact aspect of the response that is most crucial. How do we drill that up or down? There certainly is no magic to just the fact that the spleen is smaller. It undoubtedly improves the symptoms, but it's really kind of a marker of response. Well, let's pivot to the final part. There's four agents with different mechanisms of action, each with intriguing data at ASH that we'll quickly go through and kind of compare and contrast a bit where they might fit. So indeed, there's a very robust pipeline of agents, but we're going to delve a little deeper into four of these agents. The BET inhibitor from Constellation, imetelstat, navitoclax, and IMG-7289. So CPI-0610, BET inhibitor, working on myeloid diseases, suppressing cytokines, promoting erythrocyte differentiation, normalizing megakaryocyte differentiation. So John, you presented this, but it's almost a panel of different abstracts as it relates to this agent, but probably the one that's the most interesting is in the upfront setting. So in this part, and they've looked at it in each of the segments, all three have activity, but here, initial experience, CPI-0610 plus Rux, JAK inhibitor naive patients, impressive spleen volume responses, again, response rates of 67% overall. And again, with the comfort studies, we saw response rates more in the low 40s. Now, obviously, this is combination. Impressive improvements in symptoms, response rates of almost 60%, quite a bit higher than the comfort studies, but obviously this is not randomized. Improvements in hemoglobin, particularly in individuals that had some anemia, that could be a differentiator. Suggestions in a non-controlled fashion of impact on fibrosis, so suggestion of disease modification. Toxicities can cause some anemia, thrombocytopenia, some GI tox. And then there was the MANIFEST 2, the phase 3 study. This is going to be opening. It's opening now at my center. I think probably all of our centers who are on the call today, this should be interesting. So particularly if you have newly diagnosed patients, know that there are some frontline studies out there. Rux plus this agent versus Rux. So not a lot of downside is what I'm telling patients. Again, maybe a little higher risk of tox, but maybe a deeper response, nothing underneath. Now, before we pivot to talk about the drug, there was also data as it related to using this in patients who were refractory or intolerant. Now, obviously, tougher group of patients. This was the non-transfusion-dependent cohort. Improvements in splenomegaly, so relevant in the second line. Improvement in symptoms in the second line, always impressive. Again, here are some improvements in anemia, particularly those individuals without transfusions. The toxicities, again, similar to what we saw in the front line. So it looks active. What do you think is going to be the sweet spot? That upfront combination, obviously you can use it possibly in the second line, but if it was available tomorrow, would you use this in everyone in front line? If this data carried out, would you use it in a subset? Aaron, why don't you kick us off?
I'll jump in. Sure, thank you. I think that's really the tricky part about all this. So, the response rates that you mentioned in terms of spleen size and symptom reduction were almost double that in the frontline setting what we see with the comfort study, so ruxolitinib alone. But we're also seeing lots of responses in the second line setting in patients who are, intolerant of ruxolitinib or ruxolitinib didn't get them in a great response. So the big question in my mind is where to sequence this. Like you mentioned, there is increased toxicity. So is this something where we start off with ruxolitinib, go 3 months, see if ruxolitinib is going to cut the mustard, then we add in CPI-0610? Or is this something we need to start off right from the beginning doing combination therapy? Definitely, like you said, I'm looking forward to working on the MANIFEST 2 study to really kind of get some more of these answers. But, I think really digging into that frontline setting and seeing what comes of the MANIFEST 2 study is really, really exciting for patients. Again, because the response rates were so much higher than what we would normally expect with ruxolitinib alone.
I agree. Even as I try to predict the discussion you guys will have, in the panel sessions, is this everybody? I suspect not. I suspect there will be subgroups. Do you do it upfront based on a molecular phenotype or other feature? Or do you add it in after 3 or 6 months, if not an adequate response? I don't think you need to wait 4 years. I think this concept of somebody's got to completely fail and then switch to another agent, I suspect things will be a bit more fluid.
Yeah.
Well, while they have John coming up with us, let me jump into our next agent. This is imetelstat. Again, many participating with this one. John was kind enough to present this one at ASH. This initially tested by my colleagues at Mayo in Rochester. This is a telomerase inhibitor. different mechanism of action. And again, as we all start to get more gray hair, we're all much more interested in lengthening our telomeres.
Or our hair.
Very true. So active agent, they looked at two different doses. They saw improvement in survival of the higher dose versus the lower dose. And that in particular, so yes, improvements in symptoms and some in spleen, but again, a suggestion that, you know, perhaps with this mechanism of action, improvement in spleen and symptoms may not be the perfect litmus test for what's going on with the agent. You know, I'm mindful of agents like azacitidine that can improve survival in MDS, but it's not necessarily correlated 100% with how well it improves cytopenias. You know, it's doing other stuff. Here's showing that difference in improvement in survival, that lower risk of death correlated with improvement in bone marrow fibrosis. And again, here perhaps that is a litmus test. It's doing something else in the bone marrow. Undoubtedly, bone marrow and progressive disease in myelofibrosis, acquisition of additional mutations, perhaps toxic microenvironment, maybe a range of different things that are going. Patient with symptom response, again, lower risk of death. And again, that may be indicative of a variety of surrogate markers, as well as those that did have a spleen volume response. If they had it, certainly it was beneficial. So there is a phase 3 study ongoing. It's an interesting study in that the primary endpoint is survival. Here they're looking at that refractory high-risk patients, imetelstat versus best available therapy, certainly a strong consideration. So, Aaron, if you think about imetelstat, again, kind of further reinforcing this issue of survival, why do you think these patients might live longer on this agent?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, as we've been talking, there might be a kind of a deeper effect on the disease than just lowering cytokine levels, improving spleen size and symptoms. You know, I think the most telling piece of data from that presentation that John gave was the correlation between survival and fibrosis grade and change in fibrosis grade. And that's trying to connect the dots to associating some sort of tangible biomarker with better survival. And I think that's so, so important. There have been agents in other diseases approved in the past where there has been a survival advantage, but no clear mechanism why or no biomarker to follow. And it's been really difficult to employ those agents. The one we might think of is the dendritic cell therapy from Dendrion for prostate cancer. There was no kind of connection there, and that made it really, really difficult to employ in the clinic. So I think that's a really important thing, and I really think that this is a gutsy trial going for the survival advantage, and I'm really looking forward to seeing the results from this one as well.
You know, it certainly raises in my mind that, you know, perhaps, and obviously this is speculative, but the litmus test for improved survival with JAK inhibition is spleen and symptoms. Mm-hmm. But agents with other mechanisms of action, it may be different.
Yeah.
You know, and I think one would need to be mindful in terms of a dose and tolerability, but it certainly raises whether this agent combined with the JAK inhibitor could be complementary. Yeah. You know, if you could get enough of the drug in, yep. You know, that the thrombocytopenia, and again, that might suggest some of the momelotinib or pacitinib that may have less cytopenias, you know, might be naturals to kind of combine up with this.
Yep.
Well, another kind of agent taking the approach, this presented by Naveen, navitoclax in individuals with relapse or refractory myelofibrosis. They too are looking at different niches, although this year's ASH, they only presented this niche, but they're also looking up front, like CPI-0610. This is impacting apoptosis in myelofibrosis, a topic near and dear to my heart. It was the topic of my K award long ago, 20 years ago when I had that K award, but this as a BCL XL inhibitor. And this was the single-arm, second-line study for patients who had failed ruxolitinib, and they were adding it on to ruxolitinib as opposed to a complete swap-out. which I do think is a bit more patient-friendly approach when it can be employed. It's not either or, you add it on. And I think that makes it easier in terms of both transition, but also kind of judging the incremental impact. So they saw nice improvements in spleen and symptoms. And again, this was from a baseline of being on a stable dose of the agent as a single agent. So it was nice to get this incremental benefit. Most common adverse events, thrombocytopenia and GI. Again, somewhat of a recurring theme in our realm. Many of these agents active in MF can cause some cytopenias, can cause some GI side effects. They did see some early molecular responses as well as some improvement of fibrosis. Again, we have more flirting with this issue of disease modification. Fibrosis is a challenging endpoint, but several agents are flirting with this area. They also saw improvements in inflammatory cytokines. Again, I think a lot going on in that bone marrow microenvironment, perhaps in the complex microenvironment within the spleen might be relevant as well. So obviously phase two, but Aaron, you know, kind of this drug is kind of following the same sort of track as the BET inhibitor. Data is early, but what do you think? Are these parallel ships in the night? Where do you think they might fit together?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the key. And like CPI-0610, you know, where's it going to fit? And there are studies launching with navitoclax in both phases, the upfront setting and the relapse refractory setting. So I think we'll get some phase three data to kind of sort that out. I think the devil's going to be in the details. We're going to look at subpopulations in all likelihood from these studies saying, well, you know, this subpopulation did really, really well. We might choose navitoclax as a partner for a JAK inhibitor instead of CPI-0610 or vice versa. And some of that may be molecular driven, although part of the data that Naveen presented here in this abstract showed that responses seem to be mutation agnostic. So no matter what the molecular risk type was, there were the high risk mutations or low risk mutations, response rates were similar. So I think in the future, we might actually hopefully use some of this molecular data that we get on a lot of our patients with these gene panels to help direct therapy when we're thinking about add-back strategies.
Wonderful. So we had buzzed through, you know, navitoclax, CPI-0610, and imidostat. But first, let me ask you, CPI-0610, navitoclax, you know, both of these, well, they're both kind of looking at the same issue, frontline, second line, add-on strategies. Where do you think these drugs are relative to each other?
Well, I think they're both active drugs, and I would personally welcome both into the commercial space, so we have multiple options. You know, right now the data looks best, in my opinion, for navitoclax as an add-on strategy. That's what they did in the phase two study. We haven't seen any data up front, so that's an unknown. CPI looks really active, I think, combined with ruxolitinib up front, but the only way to prove that will be the randomized phase three study. And as the data matures and there's more data to look at, I think Aaron's point is well taken. If there are clear molecular signatures that associate with a specific therapeutic, that will help guide the treatment decision. We're not quite there yet, but I see no real downside in having multiple options that could be cycled for any individual patient.
No, I definitely agree. I think we're going to be learning a lot from those correlative studies. I mean, if you have ASX01, if you have EZH2, if you have, you know, any number of things, how it might impact these will be relevant. Well, the final one that we'll go through before we get to our question and answer session is the LSD1 inhibitor, bomedemstat, IMG-7289, in patients with advanced MF. I've been participating in this study and also have an ET study that we have ongoing that we can discuss at another time, but active in both of those settings. So this, again, working in megakaryocyte differentiation, and this pathway might be disease-modifying in a range of ways. 49 patients, second-line, typical features in patients who had failed. here showing the enrollment and treatment duration. So you've got really some long-term players out there, well past a year. Overall, no dose-limiting toxicity. This agent does impact, it does have a bit of a peculiar thing. It can impact taste that can lead to nausea and some other things. So I have found that to be something needed to manage around. Been a bit more of a factor perhaps in the ET study than has been reported in MF. Again, some of the rare SAEs, but these are obviously second line patients, so they're pretty high risk. Improvements in symptoms, as you see on the left, and some improvements in the spleen volume. You know, the trial is of course earlier in its arc than some of the other agents that I have presented. There were some interesting improvements in the variant allele frequency in a few different molecular phenotypes. And again, that might be of great interest, including a couple there with ASXL1. So early, but obviously that would be a highly valuable group to be improving. So where might this fit in? Do we need to really let this mature, compare it with something else? John, why don't you kick us off?
So, you know, also I think mechanistically a very interesting drug, and I think there's some signal of activity here. I think compared to some of the other studies we've discussed, where there's a lot more data, a lot more patients, it's a little bit more challenging here to really be definitive. And the reality is, if this was a drug that we were discussing, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, where the field was different, there were a lot less agents being presented at meetings, this would probably be the lead compound, but it's a competitive field right now, and it's a little hard to say how best this fits in or compares, and obviously it needs more data and I think more time, and the move to take it into ET makes sense, so I look forward to seeing that data as well.